1963 was a year of change. Change in leadership and social change. This is Bill Scott, Director of News for Radio Press International. In many ways, death became the hallmark of the year with the brutal assassination of President John F. Kennedy and the passing of Pope John XXIII. 1963 ran the gamut of human emotion and human endeavor. It was a year that began with high hopes for easing of international tensions, a year that sustained a terrible period of shock and mourning, and ended with a nation and the world community coming to understand a new maturity in its ability to cope with sudden and enormously difficult circumstances. You are about to hear the stories of the major developments of 1963, as told by the newsmen who reported those developments, with the actual voices of the people who made the news. Here are some of the sounds and voices of the news of 1963.
An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. I cannot bear this burden alone.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom now!
Now let's listen to the stories that are associated with these sounds, and to all the other stories of the year that made history and changed people's lives.
Dallas, November 22nd, and the world was changed. This is Herb Brubaker, RPI White House correspondent, reporting on John F. Kennedy and his successor on Year in Review. The Texas sun smiled as the presidential plane landed at Dallas's Love Field. An enthusiastic crowd greeted Mr. and Mrs. Kennedy. This was the last leg of a three-day visit to Texas. The motorcade slowly made its way through town. Sharing the open convertible with the president and his wife were Governor and Mrs. John Connally. Mrs. Connally explains the mood of the moment.
The people couldn't have been friendlier. The crowds couldn't have been more wonderful, more generous in their reaction to the president. I just had such a good feeling about the way they had received him in this city. I had just turned around and said to him, "You can't say Dallas doesn't love you, Mr. President."
A rifle shot punctured the autumn air. The president clutched his throat. A second shot and the governor was hit. A third bullet struck the rear of the president's head. Mrs. Kennedy screamed, "Oh no," and climbed to the rear of the car for help. The limousine sped to nearby Parkland Memorial Hospital. The president was dead. The events that followed were blurred with tears. The president was given last rites. The governor was operated on, and he survived. A policeman was shot and killed by the fleeing assassin. After a scuffle, police captured the suspect, left-winger Lee Harvey Oswald, in a Dallas movie theater. Standing in a crowded airplane compartment, Lyndon Johnson was sworn in as 36th President of the United States. And by nightfall, the body of the late president, Mrs. Kennedy, President and Mrs. Johnson were back in Washington. Jacqueline Kennedy, still wearing the pink suit in which she was dressed that morning, was splattered with her husband's blood. The next day, Washington was dark and rainy. The Kennedy family, friends, and officials visited the White House's East Room where the body lay in repose. Sunday, the flag-draped casket was placed on a caisson and drawn by six gray horses up Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol's rotunda, where the body lay in state for thousands to see. The solemn procession was interrupted by a bulletin from Dallas. Lee Oswald was being transferred from one jail to another. The nation heard it being described as it happened.
He's been shot.
Dallas Police Captain Will Fritz describes the unbelievable scene.
As we stepped from the jail door to go to the car, there, of course, was a large crowd of newspaper men there, and evidently this man slipped in among them in some way. He stepped out of those people, ran up to this man, and shot him while he was handcuffed to one of the officers.
Charged with Oswald's murder, Dallas nightclub owner Jack Ruby. Though Oswald was never brought to trial, the evidence left no doubt. His fingerprints were on the paper in which the murder weapon was wrapped. Particles of his clothing were found on the rifle, declared Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade.
I would say that without any doubt, he's the killer. The law says beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty, which I have no question that he was the killer of President Kennedy.
President Johnson later named a 7-man commission headed by Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren to investigate the assassination and Oswald's murder. Monday morning, the president's casket was again placed on the caisson. The cortege returned from the Capitol to the White House, where Mrs. Kennedy joined world leaders, including French President Charles de Gaulle, British Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume, West German Chancellor Ludwig Erhard, Canadian Prime Minister Lester Pearson, and Soviet Deputy Premier Anastas Mikoyan. Together, they walked the 9 blocks from the White House to St. Matthew's Cathedral, where a pontifical mass was celebrated. Then the funeral procession went to Arlington National Cemetery, and high on a hill overlooking the city he loved, John F. Kennedy was laid to rest. These were the words of John Kennedy at his inaugural address, January 1961.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty. All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin.
In 2 years and 10 months, the Kennedy administration made its beginning. A treaty banning nuclear tests in the atmosphere, outer space, and underwater. A Peace Corps of dedicated Americans working in remote parts of the world. A government program retraining workers displaced by automation. A revolutionary mental health program. A greater drive for equal Negro rights, greater emphasis on the arts. And the world was reminded America is tough, as demonstrated in Cuba, and when a Yale University professor was jailed and held incommunicado by the Soviets. In the dark days following John Kennedy's death, Lyndon Johnson moved boldly to continue the work begun by his administration. He conferred with world leaders, civil rights groups, business and labor spokesmen, and he made a moving address to Congress.
No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. No act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year. That bill, if passed without delay, means more security for those now working, more jobs for those now without them, and more incentive for our economy. John Kennedy's death commands what his life conveyed, that America must move forward.
What are the similarities and differences between Presidents Johnson and Kennedy? Both are political pros who exude confidence and, generally speaking, embrace the same broad philosophies. But Kennedy was an idealist. Johnson is a pragmatist. Kennedy was a voracious reader, a stickler for detail. Johnson has little patience to read. He hits at the heart of a problem rather than get enmeshed in detail. Kennedy had little luck with Congress. Johnson's 32 years' experience on Capitol Hill taught him how to handle lawmakers. Kennedy's foreign policy style had a continental touch. Johnson's has the flavor of a Texas barbecue.
The fire had been smoldering for 100 years, and 1963 will be remembered as the year in which the smoldering embers burst into flame.
We're going to moan
together. We're going to groan together. And after a while, we'll say, freedom, freedom, freedom now.
This is Hank Wilson reporting the story of the drive for equal rights during the past year. The demonstration started in pleasant springtime weather. As early as April, Negroes began demonstrating in Birmingham, Alabama. Birmingham, the city whose name was to be the standard bearer of the civil rights struggle of 1963. Police managed to quash that early April demonstration in Birmingham, but Negro leaders warned that the fight had just begun. And by early May, the integrationists were marching by the hundreds through the streets of Birmingham. By late afternoon on the 3rd of May, more than 500 demonstrators had been arrested in a period of less than 2 hours. By mid-May, it was clear the impetus behind the demonstrations was enough to keep them going. In the first week of June, the civil rights scene shifted abruptly from Birmingham to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where a federal court had ordered the University of Alabama to admit 2 Negro students for the first time in history. Alabama's fiercely segregationist governor, George Wallace, vowed to stand in the door to prevent it. On Tuesday, June 11th, the students arrived on the university grounds, and Governor Wallace was there, face to face with a Justice Department official. But within 5 hours, the Alabama National Guard had been federalized, and it was all over. That night, in a nationwide broadcast, President Kennedy praised the students of Alabama University for their restraint.
Following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of 2 clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro. That they were admitted peacefully on the campus is due in good measure to the conduct of the students of the University of Alabama who met their responsibilities in a constructive way.
Public schools let out later that month, and the demonstrations picked up steam. This is the sound of the marchers and the police dogs sent out to stop them in Cambridge, Maryland, summer 1963.
All of this group in the streets under arrest.
It became clear by midsummer the demonstrations were accomplishing their main purpose: to force concessions toward Negro equal rights in the staunchest segregationist areas. Spurred on by their successes, Negro leaders resisted any offers of gradual integration. This is the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
We must no longer feel that we can settle for tokenism. For token integration is little more than token democracy.
In Congress, hearings were beginning on the strongest civil rights bill since Reconstruction. Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett charged the demonstrations were communist instigated.
It is obvious to many of us throughout the country that the racial agitation, strife, and conflict that has been stirred up throughout our nation is largely communist inspired.
Rights leaders scheduled a massive march on Washington for August 28th. The goal, 100,000 demonstrators. The result, upwards of 200,000 converged on the nation's capital. From the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial, they marched, singing and chanting. At the memorial, they heard their leaders call for freedom, freedom now. March Director A. Philip Randolph.
I pledge my heart and my mind and my body to the achievement of social peace through social justice.
An address that was to become well known in months ahead. Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream.
I still have a dream.
Yes.
That one day,
yes,
this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And if America is to be a great nation, This must become true. And so let freedom ring. And when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Observers are still assessing the success of that march, but afterward, the press for civil rights legislation through the Congress gained steam. But there were delays, and integrationists were in no mood to wait. In early September, riots again broke out in Birmingham. A prominent Negro attorney's home was bombed. A federal court ordered two white high schools and a grade school in Birmingham integrated. Governor Wallace again refused.
"I shall continue to resist for you within the law and in keeping with the traditions of our section of the country. I shall continue our fight with dignity and integrity as we have done in the past. I can tell you that I hope that God will bless all the people of this state, both black and white."
On September 10th, I was at West End High School in Birmingham as two Negro girls entered the school to register. City police did not stop them. But the registration of the girls sparked a massive boycott of the school by white students, hundreds of whom stood outside the school building chanting, 2, 4, 6, 8, "We don't want to integrate." The boycott came to an end within a week, but the violence did not. On what began as a quiet Sunday morning, a bomb exploded in a Negro church in Birmingham, killing 4 young girls. The bombing led to meetings at the White House with both sides in the dispute. As autumn came and then winter, integrationists held fewer demonstrations. Shocked by the assassination of President Kennedy, who had championed their cause, integration leaders looked to the new president for leadership. And at year's end, though difficulties were many, it appeared that long-awaited legislation was in sight.
This is Don Folsom, RPI Capitol Hill correspondent, with a look at a long but largely unproductive year in Congress. Critics called it a do-nothing Congress, and during its first session, the 88th did very little about 4 major pieces of legislation: civil rights, tax reduction, Medicare, and general aid to education. Hospital care for the elderly, financed through the Social Security system, languished in a congressional pigeonhole at year's end. Aid to education boosters fared better, receiving at least a portion of their goal. Legislation providing college construction funds, aid to medical schools, expanding the vocational training program, and extending assistance to impacted areas was approved. But the church-state issue still stood in the way of action on aid to elementary and secondary schools. To prop up a wobbly economy, the Kennedy administration, early in 1963, proposed a program of tax reduction and reform. Treasury Secretary C. Douglas Dillon spelled out its key provisions.
"We figure that the average tax reduction for all individuals will be about 18%. This will be larger for those in the lower rates. It'll be nearly 40% for those with income under $3,000, between $3,000 and $5,000, it'll be about 28%, and for those in the $10,000 class, it will be about 21%.
An $11 billion bill, retaining most of the recommended cuts, but minus most of the reforms, eventually passed the House. Despite conservative contentions, the measure was fiscally irresponsible. Chief House Republican tax spokesman John Burns of Wisconsin put it this way.
"Our last two presidents, General Eisenhower and Mr. Truman, told us not to cut taxes unless government spending is first brought to heel. If in our eagerness for a tax cut, we ignore such wise and distinguished counsel, we will be playing Russian roulette with our own destiny."
In the Senate, the tax bill never got out of the Finance Committee, but Chairman Harry Byrd, hastened by a gentle nudge from President Johnson, forecast final action early in 1964. Neither House voted on the most controversial New Frontier proposal of the year, a comprehensive set of laws designed to deliver the Constitution to the American Negro. The package, which emerged from the House Judiciary Committee, was not as strong as one approved by its Civil Rights Subcommittee, but the administration believed it had a better chance of passing. As expected, the most angry opposition to the bill came from Dixie lawmakers, like Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina.
This so-called civil rights proposals, which the president has sent to Capitol Hill for enactment into law, are unconstitutional, unnecessary, unwise, and extend beyond the realm of reason. This is the worst civil rights package ever presented to the Congress, and is reminiscent of the Reconstruction proposals and actions of the radical Republican Congress.
At year's end, the rights measure was bottled up in the House Rules Committee, but Chairman Howard Smith of Virginia promised hearings in early 1964. If the Congress didn't work hard, it at least worked long, staying in session almost all year. Huge sums were chopped from the foreign aid program, but the president was given authority to make concessions in U.S. trade with Poland and Yugoslavia. A military pay boost averaging 14% was approved. Congress showed its ire when the Supreme Court ruled against Bible reading and prayer recitation in the public schools. All kinds of legislation aimed at overturning the landmark decision was introduced. And Congress proved, too, how fast it could move by passing in short order legislation made necessary when Labor Secretary Willard Wirtz made this assessment of the railroad work rules dispute.
The situation is that the parties have failed to come up with anything as the basis of an agreement involving the whole of the railroad industry, and the situation is that as far as the mediation process is concerned, we have so far been unable to come up with anything which would contribute to their settlement. It's as serious as it could possibly be.
The emergency legislation headed off a threatened strike and set up an arbitration board which ruled the carriers could gradually eliminate 90% of the firemen on diesel locomotives in freight and yard service. The Senate was called on to ratify the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. During hearings on the historic three-power pact, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara took this view.
I do not pretend that this or any other agreement between great contending powers can be risk-free. Surely this one is not. And even under the doubtful contingency of Soviet testing in the prohibited environments without being detected, the United States will maintain its ability to survive a surprise attack with sufficient power to destroy the Soviet Union.
Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, disagreed.
If you ratify this treaty, you will have given away the future safety of this country. You will have increased the chances of war. And therefore, no matter what the embarrassment may be in rejecting the treaty, I earnestly urge you to do so and not to ratify the treaty which is before you.
Despite such testimony, the treaty was ratified by a vote of 80 to 19. The Congress also investigated in 1963. The Senate Rules Committee probed former Senate Majority Secretary Bobby Baker's off-the-hill activities. Baker, a protege of Lyndon Johnson, resigned after his outside business dealings took on a possible conflict of interest tinge. For Senator John McClellan's investigations subcommittee, it was a busy year. The group looked into the Pentagon's award of a multi-billion-dollar warplane contract, heard former Texas fertilizer king Billy Saul Estes repeatedly take the Fifth Amendment about his toppled farm empire, and the panel took testimony from a 58-year-old convict, a small-time hoodlum for Cosa Nostra, the secret underworld syndicate popularly known as the Mafia. Until he decided the underworld was trying to rub him out, Joseph Valachi was loyal to the blood oath he had taken not to betray the organization. The avenging mobster told McClellan how a gangland cohort had initiated him during a 1930 ceremony.
There was a gun and a knife on the table. I repeated some words he told me, but I only could explain what he meant. You live by the gun and by the knife, and you die by the gun and by the knife. Well, then he gave me a piece of paper, I suppose, you know, and burn it. And then in your hand, you say, this is the way I burn if I expose this organization.
You'd be burned to ashes.
Right.
1963 will be remembered by most people in Europe as the year of change, when the old gave way to the new. Here in Europe, the process of change was peaceful, if not always harmonious. But the change that caused the greatest shock and concern was the one that took place in the United States. The change brought about by an assassin's bullet fired in Dallas, Texas. This is Noel Bernard, Chief European Correspondent for Radio Press International. The changing of the guard in the bastions of Europe had been coming for a long time, in Germany, England, Italy, and elsewhere. The grand old men who had brought Europe back from post-war depression and poverty to economic stability in the 1960s knew or were told that it was time to relinquish the reins of power. Konrad Adenauer was 73 when he took over the job of reconstructing West Germany. Now, at age 87, he finally stepped down to make way for chubby, cigar-smoking, 66-year-old Ludwig Erhard, the wizard who produced the German economic miracle, the man whom Adenauer least wanted to succeed him.
Im Haushalt 1964 so weitgehende Kürzungen vorgenommen.
Der Dicke, or the fat one, as Erhard is called, would not change much of Germany's NATO-based policies. But he did seem to prefer cabinet teamwork to Adenauer's one-man rule. Next door in France, however, change did not set in.
Que l'Iran nous apparaît comme une des conditions de l'équilibre universel et de la paix générale.
Charles de Gaulle, at 73, still was firmly in power, firmly committed to an independent nuclear force, firmly opposed to British membership in the common market, and firmly determined to lead his country to a new greatness through the creation of a powerful Europe. In Britain, the big change came somewhat unexpectedly. It came in part because of this man.
I'm leaving for the United States. You might call this a familiarization visit.
War Minister John Profumo was the cabinet minister. 21-year-old Christine Keeler, Profumo's sometime mistress, was the girl that rocked the government. And her triangular affair with Profumo and Soviet attaché Evgeny Ivanov was the story of the year in Britain. It was a complicated tale of multilateral sex, political mystery and scandal, and complex intrigue. It wound up with Christine projected to worldwide fame and then sent to prison for perjury, with Profumo resigning in disgrace and the Macmillan government nearly toppled by a dart. A later report on the security aspects of the Profumo affair exonerated the government from any charges involving a breach in the country's national security. But for many Englishmen, the morals of the nation would never again be the same. Said the embattled Prime Minister.
I did my best, and even when I have to think it over, in the end of my life, I think I'd rather carry the burden of having made a mistake and been proved wrong than have had it the other way and destroyed a man's life when he was really innocent.
For Macmillan, however, the Profumo affair proved too much. Troubled by failing health and plagued by France's veto of his efforts to join the common market, the Profumo scandal was the last straw. In October, he went into hospital for an operation, and from his hospital bed, he wrote the Tory Party's convention meeting in Blackpool of his plans. The letter was read by the then Foreign Secretary, Lord Hume.
It will not be possible for me to carry the physical burden of leading the party at the next general election. Nor could I hope to fulfill the tasks of Prime Minister for any extended period, and I have so informed the Queen.
10 days later, Lord Hume emerged as Britain's new prime minister. Behind the Iron Curtain, there was change too. The Sino-Soviet rift, which had been growing in secret, now burst fully into the open. Khrushchev called the Chinese warmongers. The Chinese called him stupid and a capitalist tool. The war of words came to a head over the conclusion of the Partial Test Ban Treaty. In Rome, too, there was change in 1963. The universally loved and respected Pope John XXIII took gravely ill. For days he wavered between life and death. The world waited and prayed. Then, at sunset on June 3rd, Vatican Radio mournfully told the world,
Pope John XXIII has died. Praise be Jesus Christ. Laudato Jesus Christus.
The new pontiff was quickly elected by the College of Cardinals. As I stood among the crowds in St. Peter's Square, a lean 65-year-old Giovan Battista Cardinal Montini appeared on the balcony above to bless the crowds and announce he would henceforth be called Pope Paul VI. One of the first actions of the new pontiff was to reconvene the Ecumenical Council, thus carrying on the work of his predecessor. When the session ended, the new pope surprised the council and the world with an announcement of historic importance.
Proximo mense januario, petere palestinum.
Pope Paul said he would make a trip to the Holy Land in January 1964, the first trip by plane by any pope, and the first pope to set foot in the Holy Land since St. Peter, the first pope. On November 22nd, the horrible news reached Europe, and it was so devastating that people refused to believe it. John Kennedy was dead. A stunned world mourned. The people of Europe were particularly grief-stricken. This was the man who had visited the continent only 6 months before. This was the man who had gone to Berlin to reaffirm the steadfastness of the American position there.
I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
This was the youthful, vital president who spoke a language that was understood in nations around the world. The crowds in Europe had cheered him wherever he went. Now he was dead, an assassin's bullet in his head. And so, as the year ended and Europe's leaders prepared for a round of talks with the new president of the United States, the continent and the world waited and wondered about the shape of things to come in 1964.
At United Nations headquarters along the East River in New York, 1963 will not be remembered as a year of crises or great accomplishments. It will be remembered, however, as the year in which the East and West found themselves more agreeable, and the year in which both sides in the Cold War found themselves at one time or another at odds with the ever more powerful Afro-Asian bloc. This is Mel Ligon, Radio Press International's United Nations Bureau Chief, with a backward glance at the events of 1963 at the United Nations in Africa and Latin America. The year started off well with a decisive military victory for the United Nations in the Congo, which had been boiling since 1960. Therefore, it was a pleased Secretary General who could tell a news conference on January the 29th,
"The United Nations henceforth will be able to direct its main attention and its resources to assistance to the Congo, including Katanga, in the broad sphere of civilian operations."
However, the Congo problem was by no means solved. Despite the world body's precarious financial situation, Uthant asked for and got the funds to keep a United Nations presence in that African country through June 1964. Then the spotlight shifted to other African trouble spots, the remaining places where independence had not yet come to Africa's natives. During the year, the Afro-Asian group brought increasing pressures on Portugal, southern Rhodesia, and South Africa from every direction. Example, Ghana's Alec Kazon Saki. Subject, South Africa's policy of racial apartheid.
South Africa is a slave state. From our point of view as Africans, when you have 3 million people dominating 14 to 15 million, expropriating them, subjecting them to all sorts of humiliation because of distinctiveness in color, that is slavery. It's worse than serfdom.
After several years of vacillation on the subject, 1963 was the year that the United Nations began to support anti-South African measures, such as a resolution urging a world boycott on arms shipments to Johannesburg. By year's end, the continuing drive for more representation for Afro-Asian nations in the United Nations councils had both East and West caught in the middle. The United Nations in 1963 also got involved with a lot of other trouble around the world. The Secretary General tried to cool off Indonesia's hatred of Malaysia after a United Nations-held survey found that two Pacific territories wanted to join the new federation and not become part of Sukarno's island nation. Despite apparent Cuban efforts, the Venezuelan government remained in power after democratic elections in December. Free elections also were held in Argentina and Peru. This was not the case in such countries as Guatemala and the Dominican Republic, where military coups in 1963 overthrew lawfully elected administrations. But the best-known coup of the year came in South Vietnam against the Diem regime. The uprising came at a time when a United Nations commission was in Vietnam to investigate alleged repression of Buddhists by the Catholic-oriented government. Said U Thant,
"The situation in the Republic of Vietnam is going from bad to worse. I cannot think of any other country today where the situation is as chaotic as the situation in that unfortunate country."
Trouble had been building up in Vietnam since May, when the Buddhist protest began to grow and government repression began to get more violent. Telling the Diem side of the story to the world was Madame Ngo Dinh Nhu, First Lady of Vietnam and sister-in-law of the President. She was in the United States during October, denying any repression of the Buddhists and warning that America was planning a coup in Saigon.
"There is a real hostility against my government, against myself from the American administration. The proof is in the fact that the economic aid has been reduced for so-called pressure. But how can we ever please the American administration if we do not even know what to do to relieve that pressure?"
When the revolt came on November 1st, Madame Ngo was left a widow without a country, her husband and brother-in-law having been killed in the aftermath of the military takeover. The problem settled, the United Nations dropped its Vietnam inquiry. Most important of all, the United Nations in 1963 was a forum, a meeting place for the statesmen of the world to talk quietly about the next steps to come in the disarmament field after the Test Ban Pact had been signed. It wasn't the total solution, of course, but it was something. And on July 26th, President Kennedy said,
"Yesterday, a shaft of light cut into the darkness. Negotiations were concluded in Moscow on a treaty to ban all nuclear tests in the atmosphere, in outer space, and underwater. For the first time, an agreement has been reached on bringing the forces of nuclear destruction under international control. This treaty is not the millennium, but it is an important first step, a step towards peace, a step towards reason, a step away from war."
And now, after the treaty, the big three foreign ministers met at the United Nations to talk about future East-West negotiations. The beginning turned into agreements on peaceful cooperation in outer space and a ban on nuclear bombs in orbit around the Earth. The Geneva disarmament talks will pick up the thread of these negotiations. Said Ambassador Adlai Stevenson,
"By avoiding a nuclear arms race in outer space, we will have taken one further step on the road to disarmament."
In September of 1963, John F. Kennedy had come to the United Nations to tell the delegates that he believed in the future of the organization. This address had hit home along the East River, and the news from Dallas on November 22nd was frightening in its impact. The President of the United States was dead, and speaking for many member nations, the Secretary General voiced a plea for the world to turn away from the violence which caused his death.
"Let us all here and now draw inspiration from his example And let us resolve that he did not live or die in vain. Let us call a truce to terror. Let us invoke the blessings of peace.
And so it was with great appreciation that the delegates welcomed the visit in December of the new American president. Lyndon Johnson spoke of the late president and the United States' continuing interest in the United Nations.
I have come here today to make it unmistakably clear that the assassin's bullet which took his life did not alter his nation's purpose. If there is one commitment, more than any other, that I would like to leave with you today, it is my unswerving commitment to the keeping and to the strengthening of the peace.
When, as the 18th General Assembly session closed up shop, most delegates went home pleased with their work. There were now 113 United Nations members, Kenya and Zanzibar having been admitted in December. And the world body seemed, as the year ended, not much closer to universal peace and disarmament, but a little closer and feeling much better at having helped make the inch-by-inch move along the road to peace.
This is Mercury Control. The countdown stands at T-minus 30 seconds and counting. All systems are go at this time.
It is May 15th, 1963. The place, Cape Canaveral, now Cape Kennedy, Florida. The occasion, astronaut Gordon Cooper's rocket-borne flight into outer space.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, liftoff.
And the mighty Atlas soars straight up into this cloudless, beautiful sky, straight up into the heavens. A beautiful liftoff.
This is Victor Jay reporting the events that made news in the space and science field and the people whose names made news during 1963, year in review. It wasn't a spectacular year in space compared to previous years. 36-year-old Major Gordon Cooper's 22-orbit flight around the Earth, the only U.S. manned space flight in 1963, was letter perfect. He splashed in the ocean 34 hours and 19 minutes after takeoff, less than 4 miles from the waiting carrier Kearsarge. Said Gordo to reporters later,
"Well, I've waited quite a long while for this flight, and I was very impressed with it. I was not overly concerned for my safety. I had every confidence that I could get it back fine. I think anybody that goes up on a space flight and says they aren't impressed, there must be something wrong with them."
A month later, not one but two Russian astronauts in two separate space capsules were orbited for 5 days. And one of the cosmonauts, as they were called, was female. Valentina Tereshkova was her name. And not only was she the world's first woman in space, but she later became part of the world's first marriage of astronauts when she was wed to Soviet spaceman Andrian Nikolaev. The space above the Earth was also the location for tragedy during 1963. Among the worst, 80 persons died in a Swiss jet crash in September, 101 in an Alaskan crash in June, 118 when a DC-8 jet plunged to Earth near Montreal, Quebec. And near year's end, a jetliner filled with vacationers homebound from Puerto Rico exploded in midair over Elkton, Maryland. Eyewitness to the tragedy was John Paxton.
There was something like a crash of lightning, then an explosion.
And when you arrived on the scene, what did you see, sir?
It was still on fire, then the ground was on fire. The parts scattered all over the place. There wasn't too much left.
There was tragedy, too, 8,400 feet below the surface. In April, the world's fastest nuclear sub, the Thresher, went down on a test dive in the Atlantic Ocean. To Admiral George Anderson fell the job of telling the world.
This is a very sad occasion for me, because very reluctantly I have come to the conclusion that the USS Thresher, which we held for a time as missing, has indeed been lost. I, on behalf of all of our people in the Navy, can give the greatest testimony to the contribution that these fine personnel of the Thresher have made to the future security of this country.
The Thresher's hull was never found. 129 men were lost with the sub. Deep below the Earth in Shepton, Pennsylvania, in August, a human drama involving three trapped men was played out for 14 days. Trapped 308 feet down in a coal mine were David Fellin, Henry Throne, and Louis Bova. After 2 weeks of harrowing inch-by-inch drilling, Bova died, but Fellin and Throne were hauled up a 17-inch wide shaft to safety. Marveled State Hospital's Commissioner Ira Mills.
The temperatures are good. Their blood pressures are good. They're feeling excellent, and they're in good spirits. I think these men are not ordinary men. I don't think an ordinary man could stand that down there and come up in the condition these men are in.
Names made news in 1963. The odds were 8 million to 1, but Mrs. Andrew Fisher of Aberdeen, South Dakota, beat the odds, giving birth to Quince in September. Her 38-year-old husband was stunned but happy.
Well, I feel good about the fact. Personally, I feel kind of tired. I've been in bed for about a day now.
Despite their premature birth, all five babies lived and were home in good condition by year's end. Sandy Koufax is a name Yankee fans won't want to remember. The 27-year-old left-hander for the Los Angeles Dodgers won 3 World Series games in October and led the West Coast team to a 4-game rout of the Yankees. The New Yorkers couldn't touch him, said Yanks manager Ralph Houk.
He's a real fine pitcher. He's got a good breaking ball, good fastball. Looks like he takes something off his curveball. Of course, it didn't surprise me. We know he's a good pitcher.
Koufax tells how it's all done.
I try not to beat myself. I try not to walk anybody. I try not to make mistakes that can beat me, like walking somebody. If you do this, you don't walk anybody, and try and stay away from the long ball, the home run. It takes 3 hits in an inning to score a run. And you can give up 12, 15 hits in a ball game and still only give up 1 or 2 runs.
Linus Pauling in 1963 became the second person in history to win 2 Nobel Prizes. His first was in 1954 for chemistry. His second was the Nobel Peace Prize.
We are beginning to move toward the world of peace and disarmament foreseen by Alfred Nobel, in which the only war waged by humanity will be the war against disease and misery.
Crime, in the most part, didn't pay in 1963. Frank Sinatra Jr. was abducted in December, released for $240,000 in ransom, but the money and the kidnappers were both picked up. A well-trained gang robbed a British mail train of $7 million. But Scotland Yard, by year's end, had arrested most of those in that plot. Natural disasters struck in Libya and Skopje, Yugoslavia, where more than 1,000 died in earthquakes. In Italy, where a dam disaster took 2,000-plus lives. In Japan, where a mine train disaster on the same November day killed 600. And in Indianapolis, where a gas explosion at an ice show in the Coliseum killed almost 100 and injured 400 more. Nelson Rockefeller's divorce and subsequent remarriage to Margaretta Fitler Murphy was felt to have hurt his political chances. Richard Burton's year-end divorce from his wife made it almost certain that he would marry Elizabeth Taylor early in 1964. Sonny Liston won a return heavyweight title bout with Floyd Patterson in almost the same time he did in their first match. Neither bout lasted beyond the first round. And newspaper strikes in New York and Cleveland were finally settled early in the year. But the New York strike had an aftermath in the death of the New York Mirror, the nation's second largest newspaper, in October. To those who loved the Mirror and either worked for it or bought it, the shock was numbing. Rewrite man Ed Quickly.
There have been rumors circulating for the whole 10 years of my employment here, but it feels like you've received a good shot in the solar plexus. Just knocked the wind out of your sails. To say it's a great disappointment is an understatement.
And those were just some of the names that made news and the stories about them that made up the headlines during 1963, Year in Review.
From the tragedy and turmoil that so indelibly marked 1963, there may have emerged some lasting good. Having undergone an ordeal of pain and frustration, and having witnessed major changes in the top echelon of world power, as well as in the social sphere, man may have come of age in 1963. He took the first cautious step towards coming to terms with the awesome power of nuclear weapons, by reaching agreement on a limited test ban treaty. Man was able to absorb the shock of the assassination of the leader of a major world power and of the Western alliance. Instead of faltering, hesitating, or panicking, people, and particularly the citizens of the United States, moved swiftly and positively to preserve their hard-won freedom and democratic processes, to continue the work they had started. If ever there was a test of a system or a people, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy was that test, and it was passed with flying colors. With this new strength, founded in tragedy, the world moves forward to a new year and new problems. 1964 may find East and West moving closer together on issues vital to the very survival of mankind. The vast, largely uncharted regions of outer space will continue to fascinate man, and scientists will seek to gain additional knowledge of those unknown expanses. Efforts initiated in 1963 to relieve man of the burdens of sickness, poverty, and hunger will be carried forward in 1964, some perhaps to fruition. There will be setbacks and disappointments in 1964, but the experiences and lessons of this year have provided man with the support, courage, and determination necessary to face and conquer them. This has been 1963, Year in Review.